Today I meditate upon my divine inheritance. The kingdom of God is at hand. I inherit everything that belongs to this kingdom. The riches and the power and the glory of this kingdom are mine now. I do not rob anyone by entering into the fullness of the kingdom of power, of joy, and of abundance. I recognize that everyone inherits the same kingdom. There is no law of human heredity imposed upon it. Evil has no history. Limitation has no past. That which is opposed to good has no future. The eternal now is filled with perfection. I always have been and always will remain complete, perfect, and whole expression of the eternal mind, which is God, the living Spirit Almighty. Today I enter into limitless variations that the Divine Spirit has projected into my experience. I know that all things are good when rightly used. I perceive that all experience is a play of life upon itself. I enter the game of living then with joyful anticipation, with spontaneous enthusiasm, and with the determination to play the game well and to enjoy it. Today I enter into my divine inheritance. I have shaken my thought loose from the belief that external conditions are imposed upon me by birth, through inherited tendencies, or race belief. I proclaim the freedom of my divine legacy of love, abundance, peace, and joy. I possess the kingdom of God, of good today in all its fullness.
Good morning. I'm Tarek. I'm an addict. So, I did mention these questions last night, so I'm going to touch on a few of them. I wanted to recap the powerlessness piece of the first step, and then talk about the breeding, what breeds the mental component, like. There's something going on inside of us that demands an anesthetic for us to be okay. I know I discovered it when I was younger, that a lot of my fears and my insecurities and my confidence would increase, my ability to socialize would increase. All of these things were altered as a result of putting a mind-altering substance in my body. And it was very effective for a very long time. And then the progression escalated, and I began to lose power, choice, and control. Then the consequences started, and I was stuck in this vicious cycle. But as we wander from the first step into the second step, and these are some good first step questions. So, you know, you hear Brandon and I joke around this idea of drug of choice. The industry calls it the DOC because they like the way that just sounds cool, right? What's your DOC? I like DONC, which is what's your substance of no choice, or your drug of no choice. And let's, for this example, let's assume that alcohol is a drug. What's your drug of no choice? And a simple joke that I use when I sponsor guys, when they tell me, "Oh, my drug of choice is meth," I'm like, "Well, if it's your drug of choice, then just choose not to do it. If it's your drug of choice, just choose not to do it." But the things we call our drugs or choice are usually the very things that we had no choice over. So I know some people are thinking semantics, but it's much deeper than that. So the first question was, my drug of no choice a necessity or something I did frequently that became a way of life? And that's on page 5 of the big book. I took a phrase and I turned it into that question. Now the question is important because I did a lot of substances that were just part of the way of life that I was living. When it talks about what became a necessity that I had to have, and I really look at that, like have to have, because when I say have to have, that means I stole and I pawned for it, and I conned for it, and I lied for it. I did all the things I swore I'd never do for it. And for me, that's crack cocaine. Alcohol, Oxycontin, the heroin, I mean, as if I had, when they came across my radar, I was going to buy as much as I could if I had some friends going downtown or something. Because the part of town I went to buy crack, there wasn't a ton of boy down there. It was like known as a crack spot. And so my ass never went to the Bluffs in Atlanta. I was like, no, I'm on Boulevard and North Avenue because that's where all the crack is. But if I had a friend going down to the Bluff, yeah, I'd send some money down there, give me a gram or something. But like, it was never a part of this construct here for me to plan out how I was getting any of the opiates. It just wasn't important to me. But what was important was hookers and crack cocaine. that was on my radar nonstop. And that's just my experience. Another question I like to look at when I'm digging into this first step is, did I ever curse? This is from page 6 of the big book. Did I ever curse myself a weakling for not being able to solve my problem with whatever your drug of no choice is? For me, I never cursed myself a weakling for not being able to solve my problem with alcohol, with opiates, with benzos, with ecstasy, LSD, any of that shit I used to do. It just never came up in my mind. But you know what I did curse myself a weakling for? Was crack. Because every time I ended up in a facility like this, it was because of that, my relationship with that substance. Right? Because we're talking about powerlessness. And powerlessness, remember, we're looking at it physically and mentally, but the big picture here was when you're powerless, you do things you don't want to do because you don't have the power not to. Does that make sense? You guys get that? Here's another question. And this is one of the times where I started to wake up to like how I'm not the alcoholic that's described in the big book. It says, this is from page 24, how powerful was my desire to stop drinking compared to my desire to stop using? When I started to look at that, the only reason I had a desire not to drink is I connected the dots that when I drank, I got high. And so if I don't get drunk, maybe I won't get high. Right? So there was some of that going on. But when you compare the two, they pale in comparison. Here's a question from page 32. What did my desire to stop drinking have to do with? Important question for an alcoholic. I don't know about you guys, but for me, I had almost virtually no consequences from drinking. None. So my desire to stop drinking, it didn't impair me gradually. It didn't gradually impair me physically or mentally. I never ended up in treatment, never had to seek medical attention because of my relationship with alcohol. Right. It was my relationship with mainly crack cocaine. And so what did my desire to stop drinking have to do with? Crack cocaine. And so I started to wake up when I was reading these questions. I was like, holy shit, this does not sound like I'm an alcoholic. Right? All right, so the next question, page 33, was I gravely, that word gravely implies heading towards death, the grave. Was I gravely affected by alcohol? Other than it was taking me back to drugs, really was the only thing. Did alcohol ever cause me physical and mental suffering? From page 36, my answer is no. And this, I think, is what to put the nail in the coffin for me. Page 37, did I ever go on drinking sprees, and how did they compare to my using sprees? A, I never went on any drinking sprees, so I don't even have anything to compare. So I'm just like, wait a second, and I get it, because the way I was brought up in this is if you lose control, then boom, you have the physical phenomenon of craving. And then there are days when you choose not to and you do it anyway, then boom, you've got the mental. But something just didn't, like for this guy sitting in front of you guys today, when I walk into a meeting and it's full of addicts, I feel much more at home than when I walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's just my reality. Right, I participate in AA from time to time, but I feel at home around a bunch of junkies. I'm just going to tell you the truth. And so this idea of welcome home is important, because you hear it when we walk into the rooms all the time. You're home. But damn it, those first 3 years of picking up white chips, I never walked into a meeting and felt like I was at home, because all I was really going to, other than this one CA meeting on Friday night, was all AA meetings. Now, look, I'm looking at this in hindsight. I really can't tell you with any certainty that was playing a factor back then. But as I think back on it, You know, I remember sitting in meetings like feeling like I don't belong here. You know, these people are not like me, right? I'm smarter than these people. That happened to me a lot. And so these, I'm just throwing all of these points out for your consideration. And then on page 48, what was the great persuader? What beat me into a state of reasonableness? Clearly for me, it was the cocaine that beat me into a state of reasonableness. And so when I look at those questions, I start to see this. I'm powerless over all this stuff. So again, this guy sitting up here is not saying you can go do any. I can't go do any of those things because I'm still powerless over them. But I'm not powerless over them the same way I'm powerless over crack cocaine. That's just my experience with that part of the first step. Because what happens is when we attempt the desperate experiment of the first one, or we fall victim to the peculiar mental twist, the effect is we take one, right? And for guys like us, well, most of us maybe, I don't know if I can speak for all of us, when we take one, that one takes us, you know? Tarek takes the first blast, and somewhere after the first one, Tarek's not even involved in the equation anymore. And for you, those of you who drink, the terminology would be, you know, Brandon takes the drink and the drink takes Brandon. You know, somewhere between the second and the fifth drink, Brandon's not involved in the drinking process anymore. There's something else that's come alive. And we call that the phenomenon of craving. And then we go through what we call the alcoholic addict torture of obsessive and compulsive behavior. And then we're sitting in a hotel room, some trap hotel, right? This is my story. Been in there 3-4 days. I hadn't showered. I'm running out of money. And I'm in the mirror. I mean, I've got Stims everywhere. I've got Chore Boy everywhere. My hands are all black. I've sweat through my clothes. And I'm looking in the mirror, and this little tear starts to come down out of my eye. And I say to myself, you're a piece of shit. You're going to be a junkie for the rest of your life. You know, what are you going to do here? Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make a firm resolution right then and there that I'm not doing it again. Right? I make that firm resolution, but nothing happens, right? I just make a firm resolution, and then the unmanageability. So we've got external unmanageability, which we're going to say DUIs, jails, deaths, relationship issues. Those are your external unmanageability. But then you've got this internal unmanageability, and the Big Book describes it really well. Restless, irritable, discontent, problems in personal relationships. I can't control my emotional natures. I'm prey to misery. I'm prey to depression. I'm full of fear. I'm unhappy. I can't make a living, or I hate what I'm doing to make a living, or I'm of little help to other people, so I feel worthless or useless. I'm uneasy. I'm easily annoyed, and I'm not satisfied. Any of those sound familiar? That's internal unmanageability, boredom, anxiety. And what happens is we need an anesthetic to calm that stuff down. But what happens is we conveniently forget what just happened on that little 3-4 day run that I took. Right? Remember the tear out of the corner of the eye? I have no access to those memories. It's like they were filed away somewhere in my nervous system and I cannot access them. Right? It's like, do not enter. You cannot get a file out of this drawer.
So you can't just smoke crack like a gentleman?
No, that does not work for guys like us. But we will try the experiment, right? And this is the vicious cycle. So there are two miracles that have to happen in this process. The first miracle happens quickly, and it's called the miracle of separation. All of you sitting in this room have had that happen. You've been separated, and it happened really quick, and now you're sitting here. The unfortunate truth is the second miracle takes much longer, and that is called the miracle of returning sanity. Sanity around the first drink, and it has layers, but that's the top layer is the sanity. The Big Book will later call this the position of neutrality or recoil as if from a hot flame. But this is the second miracle, and it is something that requires effort, and it requires an intellectual surrender. But then there's a part of the first step that you cannot work with a sponsor. So, you know, as Brandon and I sit up here and we share with you the experience around powerlessness, there is an intellectual process going on for you guys, and it's called I call it an intellectual surrender. But then there's a surrender that's a spiritual surrender, and that one you cannot work, you cannot make it happen. It's either happened or it hasn't, right? And the funny thing is, in the back of the book, in the family afterword, I think it's that chapter, there's this little sentence that's hidden in the big book that very few people talk about because it probably terrifies them. It says, God either has removed your mental obsession or he has not. I know why we stay away from having too many conversations about that, because that means I'm not really involved. It means I really don't really, I mean, it's not up to me. That's a scary proposition. Because what are we told here? We're told to get a sponsor, work the steps, you know. Clean house, what is it? Clean house, trust God, work with others. Are those like the three things? And we're going to make it. And maybe most of the time we do. But I've seen people in my time do that thing, and for whatever reason, they fizzle out after 2 years. They fizzle out after 3 years. They fizzle out after 4 years. Why is that? Because I think, to a degree, it has to do with this spiritual surrender. So there's intellectual surrender, which is going through your experience and identifying loss of control, physically and mentally. And then looking at the unmanageability and how that's the breeding ground for the mental obsession, or the state of being that allows us to fall prey to the strange mental blank spot, or the peculiar mental twist of our illness, where we don't have any intention of getting high, we haven't been thinking about it, but we're out to dinner with this really attractive woman that we want to get to know, and I'm too ashamed to tell her I'm in AA, right? And she orders a drink, and I'm terrified. I'm not going to tell her I'm trying to be sober, so I'm going to order a drink. No ideas about it. No premeditation at all. But I have heard that experience. I've lost track of how many times in 12 and a half years. Okay? So, the vicious cycle of addiction. You know, that's what we're talking about. It's broken by a miracle of separation. All of you have had that miracle take place. You've been separated. But now this intellectual surrender versus a spiritual surrender. And my only suggestion is you know, start praying. acknowledging, you know, not even a prayer of supplication, which means I'm asking God for something. More of, God, thank you for surrendering me, you know. Live through me in such a way today that I am surrendered, right? Every single day, right? And then one day you'll wake up like I did and you'll realize you haven't prayed about God keeping you sober in years. And why is that? Because the thought that I'm not going to be sober never occurs to me. I don't know when that happened. It just happens. At some point, I think it happens for all of us that stay on this path. I don't know. Maybe some people just continue to pray for it because it's a sign of humility. I get that. There's nothing, no downside to doing that at all. But it hit me a few years back that it had been a very long time since I'd asked God to keep me sober or keep me surrendered or any of it. And it is a scary proposition to wonder, have I been spiritually surrendered? Because it happened to me in that courtroom that I talked about last night when I looked at my mother. And that unacceptance, like, it became unacceptable to live that way. And I became willing to do whatever I had to do to never be in that position again. And that's what stuck with me. And then it was reinformed that morning in my kitchen when my drug charges just completely vanished. And then it was like a recommitted third step decision that I made that morning in my kitchen, that I'm going to do this, live this way of life that this big book talks about the best I can from here on out. And that's what unmanageability is. When you first get clean and sober, unmanageability is dominated by external stuff and internal stuff. But as you stay away from a drink and a drug, and you start to get 3 months and 6 months and 9 months and a year and a year and a half and 2 years, you start to see that the unmanageability is something totally different. It's an unmanageable internal condition, right? And that's what I really had at age 14 and 15 when I first started feeling the power of alcohol and smoking pot. right? And then at age 17 and 18, I got into music and I got into Widespread Panic and Fish and the Grateful Dead, and I discovered this magical combination of drugs that you could take on any given night and get free from your mind. But what I was really doing for 3 hours every night was getting free from my internal condition, right? I just didn't want a past, I didn't want a future, I just wanted to be there. Now, I can describe it in spiritual terms like that because of I've reflected on it. I didn't know that's what was going on. It felt fucking good. Well, what felt really good was a combination of drugs, alcohol, but also being present. I was free for a short period of time. And, you know, that became an addiction in itself, right? Because what happened was that state of being was so addictive to me that I began to lack proportion and the ability to think straight around it. So I was doing whatever I could to recreate that every single opportunity I could get. Why? Because I wanted to be free of the internal condition. I didn't want to be uneasy anymore. I didn't want to constantly be in constant collision with people and just trying to like fit that proverbial square peg into a round hole. And I was dissatisfied with where I was in life. And so the only way not to think about it was to get free of the internal condition. But then the progression happens. But this is what unmanageability is. Now, the big book focuses on it on page 44, 45, and 52. And on page 44, they sum up everything you've done. It said, if you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, which is a mental. You can't make a decision and stay stopped. Or when drinking and or using, you have little control over the amount that you take, you are probably an addict and or alcoholic. And you might be suffering from an illness. This is the most important part of that paragraph. You might be suffering from an illness which only, and that word should be put in bold and circled, only a spiritual experience will conquer. And the word only is so important because this is where you ask yourself, do I believe that statement is true? Is this my only solution? Because here's another cold, harsh reality for you. If it's not, the chances of the 12-step process working for you are very slim. 12 steps are very effective when you're brought to two alternatives. I'm either going to die or live life this way. Live life on a spiritual basis or die the alcoholic or addict death. That's when the 12 steps. But if you have an option C and an option D and an option E and an option F, you're going to burn those all to the ground until you're left with two options. And pray to God that, you know, I pray to God that you guys don't, you know, overdose or die in a car accident or something before you get down the two alternatives. But that's, you know, they on page 44, they introduce you to the idea of agnostic and atheist. On 45, they tell you that this is a power by which you can live. And that threw me for a loop because all I wanted in early recovery was to not drink and not drug. But then the book talks about this is a power by which you can live. You live a way of life that makes it impossible for you to seek a solution in a drink or a drug. And then they said, hey, you know, you've been really willing to communicate with God, your higher power, about solving your alcohol problem or your drug problem. Why don't you use that same type of willingness and apply it to human problems like personal relationships, like fear and misery, depression, uselessness, happiness, all of those things? Why can't we do that? You know, and that's what a lot of the We Agnostic chapter is going to set you up to do, and Brandon's going to take us through that. And before I turn it over, that was it. That's how we're going to conclude the first step. We looked at it physically. We looked at it mentally. We looked at it spiritually. Do we have any questions about the first step? All right. So let me boil this down to two questions. Somebody came up to me and said I left half the question off last night. So the first part of the first step, powerlessness. There's two questions. When I drink or use, do I lose power, choice, and control over how much? The majority of the time. That's for physical. The mental question is, when I stop, and I always stop eventually, can I stay stopped on my own power? Those are the two questions. Everything that we discussed, not everything, the majority of what we've discussed up to this point is reinforcing those two questions, right? Now, the spiritual malady or the unmanageability is what we just discussed. That's the trigger. That's the breeding. When they talk about triggers, that's the only real trigger, right? How many people in here got high when they were broke or drunk? High or drunk when you're broke? All right. How many people got high or drunk when they had money? How many people got high and drunk when they were happy? How many people got high and drunk when they were sad? How many people got high and drunk when they hung around people that were productive members of society? How many people got high and drunk when they hung out with people that were at the low end of society? All right. How many people got high and drunk when they were in the good part of town? How many people got high and drunk when they're in the bad part of town? So please explain to me what a trigger is again.
Everything.
Exactly.
Oxygen is usually.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the idea that I'm going to shield myself and live a life of avoidance all the time just doesn't sit well for me. I'd rather you guys live a life of freedom. I mean, my ex-wife, I don't like using the word ex-wife, you know, but I was married to this woman for 7 years. And I don't have anything negative to say about her. We're just not married anymore. But she was the director of human resources at Sweetwater Brewery in Atlanta. I had alcohol in my house all the time. She had her little THC vape pen all the time, right? I mean, we had some little rules around that kind of stuff. And every once in a while, she'd do some coke or eat some Molly and stuff. And, like, I lived the position of neutrality. I never had any temptation or desire, ever, for 7 years. And I'm not saying the first thing you're going to do when you leave the bridges is go find a woman that can do, you know, so you can have some vicarious pleasure through that. That's not what I'm saying here. I'm sharing that with you because the position of neutrality and the 10-step promises are a real thing, right? They're a real thing. And so what the trigger is the internal condition. That's why we work these 12 steps and we develop a relationship with a power greater than ourselves, because somehow when we turn to God to address the bedevilments, it deepens our experience with God, of our understanding. And the really cool thing is, at some point I started to see when these things were showing up in my life, it was creating a need to have God in my life. So if I don't have character defects and I don't have the bedevilments, do I have a need for God? I know it's quite interesting to look at it. And it's like, oh, I don't want to invite all this stuff into my life. Well, the reality is it's part of the human condition. So good luck with it not occurring in your life. It's going to happen. It is part of the human condition. But the judgment that happens as a result of it is what has drastically been minimized. And the possibilities of why it's happening have increased. Like, it's not always a negative. You know, because of what this way of life has asked me to practice over the years. Now, I don't want to get ahead of myself because we're going to talk about this stuff as the day progresses. But that is the first step in a nutshell, a very large nutshell.
So page 43.
Yes. Well, the only way to answer your question is to share my experience. So if you were coming to me and having we're having this conversation and you are new, I'm not going to care about getting you into like one or the other really it's not that important to me when someone is like brand new and they're struggling with it, because I don't want the process to be harder than it already is. But you've been around for a minute and you've worked a lot of steps. And so what I would invite you to do is answer these 21 questions, you know, because the past is a funky thing to access the further you get away from it. And so do you just get to this place where you answer this question for yourself, because you are a student of the big book. And so I'm not going to sit here and answer that question for you. But I would have this same conversation with you and take it into prayer and meditation and just see what happens and be okay, because it is possible for someone to be both. I just know in 12 and a half years, I've met very few people that are a real alcoholic and a real addict. And you might be one of them. But I'm not going to sit here, because the way you just described it, it sounded like both of them beat the shit out of you. All right? I just know that wasn't my experience. And so I'm not going to try to bring you over to my side. I share this, and I get it. You guys are in early sobriety, but, you know, if you're confused about what I'm laying out for you, then you need to talk to Roscoe and Bill about it, right? Because that's not my intent here. My intent, if you really look, I mean, I've been sponsored for a long time, and it's pretty, I mean, people can get to one or the other pretty quick, right? Especially if they haven't been to treatment very many times. But what happens when you go to treatment over and over and over, now you've been institutionalized, and they're much more difficult, because that is a drug. That's all the same thing. And I just like to have clarity. I mean, I've always been a guy that looks for clarity. I mean, people are, you know, they'll debate with me whether this is important or not. You guys got to understand, yeah, this is the way I'm showing up this weekend, but I don't always have this conversation with people I'm taking through the steps, because my intuition says, this guy, I don't need to do this, because this is probably going to confuse him more than help him. But then there are other guys that have been bouncing in and out for a long time, and they're posed with this idea of, holy shit, I never did feel at home when I was going to those AA meetings. And then we start to talk about some stuff. Okay, do you think it may have had something to do with maybe you felt like you were different because you didn't drink all that much, but yet you've been calling yourself an alcoholic for all these years because all these treatment centers said, you're an alcoholic, right? I'm an alcoholic. My name is so-and-so. So much of this comes from experience, you know, of sponsorship. And we're going to talk about that later. But there's no hard and fast rule. This is the part of me that has changed over the years. Because I used to believe that you had to do it one way. And I can't. I have to attempt to meet people where I'm at, where they're at. So I need to go down and okay, this person, yeah, I can have this conversation with. This person, I can't have the conversation. With you, Roscoe, I'm just like, look at these 21 questions and just dig into your experience and then be okay with whatever comes. If you find you're both, then you're both. You know? And another cool exercise, if you're wondering, is if I cleared this table out, right? I was at a workshop back in 2010. And this guy, Mike Dolphin, man, he's one of my heroes. We come in from break, right? And he's got a bag of cocaine sitting on the table. It looks like an ounce, right? He's got a bag of marijuana sitting on the table. He's got a handle of like Jack Daniel or Jim Beam. He's got some pills set up over here. And he had something else. And we're all of us are like, what the fuck is going on? Oh, God. And, you know, he's like, if you... he sat there and it was complete silence for like 5 minutes.
Like all ninja shit, yeah. Like just looking at you.
And he goes, if any of you have a problem with this being up here, then you haven't had a vital spiritual experience as a result of the steps. It was wild. We later come to find out it was flour and oregano. And without the liquor was real. But as you do that exercise... If I told you you were going to die a miserable death in this cabin out in the woods, that's it. This is your lot in life. This is what's going to happen. But here's the good news. For all your days in that cabin over there, you get to take one of these things off this table. You can't take two. You can just take one.
Unlimited supply.
Unlimited supply until you croak in this cabin out in the woods. Like for me, and there's a endless supply of rock sitting on this table. And there's Xanax and Klonopin and all these things. I don't even have to even contemplate. I'm taking the crack. And an endless supply of Chore Boy and Stims. I'm going to go park my ass in that cabin. That's it. Like, I don't even have to think about it. And the idea that it's miserable, and I know it's going to mean miserable, doesn't even faze me, right? Because I know those. I want those blasts so bad, right? And I can talk about it. I'm 12 and a half years removed, but I know for certainty that's just where I'm going to go. Now, some people struggle with that exercise, and they insist they got to take two, right? I'm like, look, man, you get to take one. Which one is it? Maybe that has something to do with what's going on for you. You know, I mean, it's just, you can have some fun with this stuff. It doesn't have to be all, you know, unpleasant, you know, but knowing what you are, I think is important. I just think that's important.
For me, it's important to know what you got because of sponsorship and being able to help somebody else. It was after a CA meeting, and about five or six of us standing around, and they're all talking about like smoking shit out of potatoes and light bulbs and beer cans and stuff, and like I'm sitting there listening to them, and they're all talking, and Tarek goes, "Everybody look at Brandon," and they all look at me, and he goes, "He has no idea what we're talking about," and it was true. Because I'm straight alky, right? I smoked pot twice, ate mushrooms once. Shit didn't do anything for me, right? But alcohol, like, let's go rage, right? Like, so for me, there was no desire to ever seek anything else because I found the thing that worked, right? But now here's where that's important when it comes to sponsorship, is there's not a single alcoholic in this room that would take me more than, I'll say 5 minutes, probably take me 2 minutes for me to hook up with them and them to know I got what they got. That's all it'll take. A couple stories, a couple of nods of the head, boom, we're hooked up, right? I speak alcoholic. Okay, now, an addict comes to me, we can have a conversation. It's going to take me a little bit longer to get hooked up with them. I can get hooked up with them, but I'm not going to really understand his experience, right? And so I think it's really important to get hooked up with people that are like you so that they can call you out on your shit, right? Like, I've sponsored a heroin addict before, and I thought he was getting high, and I'm calling everybody I know, like, what does it look like when a guy starts getting high? You know, they're telling me, and I'm like, okay, I'm looking for that. But, like, an alcoholic, two words on a phone, see him walking across the room, I know whether or not he's been drinking. Just know it. I see it. I mean, how many of you have gone to like some place to get away from wherever you were, because where that was the problem, and you walk into a place and you see a dude and you know he's got it. You know he's got what you're looking for. You haven't had a conversation. You walk in, you give him a nod, he gives you a nod, and you're like, go out. Right? You know. Right? So there's a bunch of spiritual realm stuff going on there that we can get into some other time. But, you know, I want to touch on, you know, I was in a meeting. It was one Friday night. Never seen this lady before. Never seen her since. And she shares this thing that really kind of hooked up with me. Remember I told you I had that night where I wanted to shoot myself in the face, and it scared me and sobered me up for 4 days. And then within the next 2 weeks, I lost everything else that I thought was important. Okay. So for me, there was an internal brokenness that happened that night that I wanted to shoot myself in the face. And then 2 weeks later, the external shit fell away, right? Now, for most people, it's the other way around. The external falls apart, they get in treatment, they start working the steps, and the inside starts, like, falling away. But I think that there's an element of both that internal and external brokenness that has to happen for you to become open to the possibility. Now, the fact that I wanted to kill myself, which seems like pretty extreme, right? That would be, most people would say, the worst you can get. But it wasn't enough for me. I was confused by it, until this lady was sharing this internal, external brokenness thing and getting down and getting real with that. And that, to me, when you get to that place, then it brings you to the bottom of page 43 that says, once more, just in case the other 42 times we said it, you didn't pay attention to it, the alcoholic or addict at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink or drug, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. I'll read this one to you. This is called Donkey. Dismount your donkey at the summit. Some places in this world are very hard to climb, and people use animals. Each person can only ride one, and each animal might have a different name. The riders go up the trail in different orders, and they discuss their varying opinions about their experiences. They may have even had conflicting opinions. One traveler may think the trip thrilling. Another may find it terrifying. A third may find it boring. At the summit, all the travelers stand in the same place. Each of them has the same chance to view the same vistas. The donkeys are put to rest and graze. They are not needed anymore. We all travel the path to spirit. The donkeys are the various doctrines that each of us embraces. What does it matter which doctrine you embrace as long as it leads to the summit? Your donkey might be a Zen donkey. Mine might be a Tao donkey. There are Christian, Islamic, Jewish, and even agnostic donkeys. AA donkeys, CA donkeys. All lead to the same place. Why poke fun at the others for the name of their donkey? Aren't you riding one yourself? We should put aside both the donkeys and our interim experiences once we have arrived at the summit. Whether we climbed in suffering or joy is immaterial. We are there. All religions have different names for the ways of getting to the holy summit. Once we reach the summit, we no longer need names, and we can experience all things directly. So, if I were to ask you to describe the Western God that we have, how would you describe God physically? Give me some characteristics of God that you might throw out there.
Powerful.
Powerful. Long hair. So you guys have to speak up. I can't hear you.
Omnipotent,
but like physical characteristics. Long beard.
Sandals.
White robe.
Sandals.
Fire on the eyes.
Huge.
Colors his hair.
White.
Huge guy, right? Okay. Interesting. So if I were to ask you to describe Zeus, how would you describe Zeus? Would it kind of be very similar to the God that you just described, that's the current Western God? So, curious, if this pagan religion, which had Zeus, and this, we're going to say this, because we live in this country, this Christian ideal of a God that's depicted on the roof of the Sistine Chapel, that's essentially what we just described, they look the same. How is that possible? If you start to question these things and you start to experience these things, then when we're tasked with questions like this, to be doomed to an alcoholic or addict death or to live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. Two options, right? I can go on with the way that I've been living and die, or I can accept some spiritual help. Then maybe it's time to start exploring what this God thing really is, right? Because there's very few people. I'm sure there's one, but I can't recall anybody that I talk to that believes that they're atheist or agnostic, that when I really talk to them, and really get down to what they think atheism and agnosticism is it's just that they don't believe in the Christian God. And because we live in this world that it's duality, right? It's either A or B, right? Roswell, New Mexico, back in the middle of the 1900s, there was the Air Force came out and they said that they saw a UFO. Okay. The next morning they came out and they said it was a weather balloon. What did they do? They created the argument. It was either a UFO or it was a weather balloon. What was it not? Anything else, right? So it's either this or that. Well, we live in a society that's laws, and the structure of it is based on the Christian belief. And the Christian belief is very defined as you believe in Jesus Christ, the one and only Savior, or you're going to hell. What does it leave out? The other question I like to ask people that tell me that God doesn't exist is, have you ever been wrong about anything in your life? Is it possible that you're wrong about this? Okay, because I'll tell you that morning that I got down on my knees, or that evening that I got down on my knees when I was doing that weepy cry thing, and couldn't fall asleep because she was in the guest bedroom and my life as I knew it was coming to an end. And I crawled down and I prayed to that God that I didn't really believe in and just said, God, please make it better. I didn't know what I was praying to. I didn't know what I was trying to hook up with. You know what I wanted? Just to feel better. So if you really get down with that first step experience and you start to realize that it doesn't matter what you do, if you look at your experience and all of the experience of your life, you end up in the same place every single time. Every single time. And that you're completely doomed, as the big book says, completely fucked, as Tarek says, then you start to open up to this possibility of perhaps there is a way that I haven't explored. Maybe this God thing. Like I couldn't, it was probably 2 years. I was probably 2 years sober before I could actually use the word God without getting a little, I had to call it the universe or spirit or higher power because I had this thing, this belief, this resentment against this God that I didn't believe in. But if I didn't believe in him and I had a resentment towards him, then I had to acknowledge that it existed. Can't be mad at a God that doesn't exist, but yet all these people that don't believe in God are mad at God. It's like, well, hold on. It doesn't exist. How are you mad at it? And an atheist believes that they don't believe in anything, but just believing in nothing actually is a belief in something. So, okay. So we're stuck at the second step. We're stuck at this place where we believe that if a mere code of moral or better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism and drug addiction, that many of us would have recovered long ago. Stick with the winners. Think the drink through. Do the next right thing. Those are better philosophies of life or a code of morals, right? If we could do it for her, do it for the kids, do it for all these reasons that everybody always told us we should do, we'd be good. If alcohol and drugs are our problem, the day that you leave treatment, you're set. Nothing more to do. If alcoholism and drug addiction are your problem, then when your solution of that, drugs and alcohol is taken away, shit gets real. You know, people all the time tell people that if they stop drinking and drugging that they'll feel better. It's true. You feel resentment better. You feel anger better. You feel irritation better. All those things. They're more real. They're all on you. And so what we have to do is we have to access something. Something that's bigger than us. Because it says, lack of power, that was our dilemma, right? And people that want to argue that, well, there isn't a power greater than me, okay? Who in here is, in the middle of the room, is here by choice, okay? Not a lot of you, right? You're here because you were forced to come here. So whatever forced you to come here is a power bigger than you, right? The police, anybody believe in that? Them? That's a bigger power. Drugs and alcohol, bigger power. Make the sun not come up. Mother Nature's a bigger power. So gaining access to that is what we're really here to look at. So then we're posed with the second step proposition. And on page 47, it's in parentheses in the middle of the page. It says, do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? I like to change that because I like it to be bigger. See, I'm an alcoholic. I like to overdo things. And so that question's not big enough for me. So do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself that can transform and make my life better in every way than I ever thought was possible? That's how I like to word the question. Because if I word it that way, then I'm a little more interested in trying to hook up with this thing, right? Gaining access to that. You know, one of the greatest prayers I heard in early sobriety was the guy said, every morning I ask God to show himself to me. And what that does is, number one, if you're asking God to show God's self to you, you're acknowledging that there is something. Number two, you're going to be looking for it. You're going to be paying attention. And then when things show up, those coincidences show up, you're going to start cataloging them. I've got a buddy that writes them all down in a notebook every time they show up in a strange way. Because they're fascinating and they're wonderful. I used to call people every time I saw God show up in my life in this strange little way. And the reality was, I got tired of calling people because it happened so much. So when you really start to hook up with this thing and you really start to understand that there is something, right? And the cool thing is that it's something that you get to decide what it is. One of the exercises I have guys do around this step is write out what you think God is. All the characteristics that God is. And then I want you to write a second one, which is what you want God to be. And then I tell them to start praying to the second one. And you know what happens? That's what God becomes for them.
Jump in here somewhere. Sure. Later on in the book, there's going to be this phrase, a little passage that says, "Be quick to see where religious people are right and make use of what they offer." And we're all going to be led to read, at least I hope. I think part of walking a spiritual path means you become like a detective or an investigator, right? And you're just constantly investigating. And the cool thing is you're never going to find anything certain. But you will stumble across many things that make you think deeply, or they land deeply in you. And every once in a while, because I read, and that's another thing that's fascinating. You want to talk about psychic change. I hated reading prior to being 31 years old. Like, I did it because I had to get through school, but the idea of reading to, like, as recreation, I mean, where that came from, I have to give the credit to this guy named Mark Houston, I think, because I listened to him, and that man always talked about, I remember the first time I heard him talk about this coffee table he had, where he could raise the top of the coffee table and he'd put his books in it, and that's where he kept all his books, and he'd get them out in the morning, and he worked with it. He never used the word read. He always used the word, "I work with books." And I went and found a coffee table that raises the top, and like I've got it. And so I love to read, is what I'm trying to get at. And that's not something that I just stumbled into. It was like a fire lit up, and I was like, man, there's so much cool stuff. And you know, sometimes it's like I run across a lot of people that got their God figured out, and there's no room for anything new, right? Possibilities close. I know exactly what it is. This is my formula. And boom. And their worlds get really shaken sometimes when stuff occurs that doesn't match their idea of only a loving God that only provides me with light. Well, if I'm going through a dark 6-month period in my life, I'm going to feel abandoned by that God. Right? And maybe, not to say that feeling abandoned isn't part of the spiritual experience, because to a degree I think it has to be. Because it leads us back to God, right? To come out of the darkness. But all religions, perhaps all religions, worship the same reality. You know, is it for God to teach them that this God is one in spite of the divergences of their doctrines and creeds concerning the concept of God? For this concept of God has an essence that is truly unique, and the divisions and relations to God do not involve divisions of his essential reality of being one. All the beliefs which are professed about God are God and the same God, just different names. Now, the multiplicity of names does not imply multiplicity of what is being named. He has a name in all languages, which are infinite in number, but that does not affect his unicity and the fact that he is one being pervading all of existence. And so, you stumble across passages like that. And to me, when I was reading that just now, I thought of Brandon last night doing his exercise. You know, it truly is, you know, God can be whatever you believe. That is God, period. But the wonderful thing about freedom is we get to change our minds. You know, that's what true freedom is I can change my mind at any given point. Just because my dad or mom said so, or the church said this, or the synagogue said this, or the mosque says this, or the Bible says this, or the Dhammapada says this, or the Quran says this, or the Bhagavad Gita says, and I've read most of those books I just listed. Why? Because I just like to investigate. I think they're all right. And I think they're all wrong. And that's a cool place to be, because it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is the investigation. That's what matters to me. And that's what, to me, the second step is really all about. It's just about, are you willing to investigate? Are you just willing to investigate? And it can start with a simple willingness, right? Brandon asked the question, you know, or not the question, but he was given his descriptions of, like, Mother Nature. That was a turning point for me. I was in the basement of a treatment center. I'd picked up my last white chip. We had just gotten back from rec. We were doing the second step out of the 12 and 12. It was a beautiful afternoon. It was sunny. And, man, I remember the treatment center I was at had a dock and then a lake. And we were sitting in the basement. And like the birds were chirping and the way the sun came off the water and created that glare. And we're sitting there covering the second step, and I still remember Andy to this day. He was talking about, you know, looking outside, and he goes, you guys, the wind is blowing, the sun is shining. He goes, let me ask you guys a question. Do any of you have the power to keep that sun shining or to keep that wind blowing or keep that light shining the way it's glimmering across the water and those birds chirping? Do you guys have anything to do with that happening right now? And of course, every single one of us in that little meeting said no. He goes, well, guess what? That's a power greater than yourself that's allowing that to happen. And he goes, that's all you need to take a second step in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, holy shit, it can be that simple. But typically, it's only that simple if you've had a spiritual surrender. Because the guys that have been spiritually surrendered, like when I got to the second and third step, I did not care. I didn't care the word God was there. I didn't care the word higher power was there. I didn't care about psychic change. Like, whatever spiritual terminology was being used, all I could see was, I need to get step four. That's all I could fucking see was, I have to write this inventory. I've got to do this fifth step. I've got to get to this eighth step as quickly as possible. Like, my ass was on fire. And that was all because of that surrender that I experienced. And this guy, Dante, had convinced me that I was looking through a temporary window that was open. And he called it the window of grace. And he was like, it closes on everyone. No one knows when their window is going to close. Because the size of your window, everyone in here has a different size window. I've run into poor guys, their window must be like this big. I'm talking, they got to move.
They get an arm through it.
And then I've met guys that have like huge windows. They took like 7-8 months to work the steps, and they're still sober to this day. It's one of the bewildering things about this process. But what's important here for me is this. And willingness to just see what's out there. Like, am I willing to believe that what this guy's talking about worked for him? That's sometimes all you need. Like, you guys are believers that what Roscoe and Bill talk about throughout the course of the week, or what Brandon and I talk about, you're like, damn it, you know what? I don't know if this shit's going to work for me, but I know it worked for them, and I'm willing to go off of that. I've heard that story countless times in my time here. I know it works. Whatever it is, there has to be that willingness to investigate, to me, is what's really important. Am I just going to see what this is all about?
On one proposition, however, Bill and Roscoe and Brandon and Tarek and Will and Bobby are strongly agreed. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than themselves. This power has in each case accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. So here we are, all these dudes that I just named, we flatly declare that since we have come to believe in a power greater than ourselves, and we've taken a certain attitude towards that power, and then we've done certain other things like work the steps, there has been a revolutionary change and their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of total failure of their human resources, shared that experience of my last Tuesday with you. I was at the limits of my human resources or the resources of the city of Harwich, Massachusetts, and the state of Georgia's court system. I was at the end of those resources. And I found a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into me. This happened way back when I wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements like working the steps. Because before then, I was confused and baffled by the seemingly futility of existence. And if you, like, Tuesday drinking wasn't even on the table, right? But it was unsatisfactory. So what did I do? I turned to the power, and a change came over me. And it's that consciousness, okay? Consciousness, that actually knowledge and interaction with the presence of God, that at least for me two Tuesdays ago was the most important fact in my life. So if you can access that, then that would seem like a pretty good reason to have some faith, wouldn't it? So again, have you ever been wrong about anything before? Is it possible that you're wrong about the way that you believe in God and the steps and the process that you can go through if you just actually work the steps? Right?
I'm going to read a little poem. It's called A Basket of Fresh Bread. There's a basket of fresh bread on your head, yet you go door to door asking for the crust. Knock on the inner door, no other. Slosh knee deep in clear stream water, you keep wanting a drink from other people's water bags. Water is everywhere around you, but you see only barriers that keep you from the water. A horse is moving beneath the rider's thighs, yet still he asks, where's my horse? Right there under you. Yes, this is a horse, but where is the horse? Can't you see? Yes, I can see, but whoever saw such a horse? Mad with thirst, he cannot drink from the stream running so close by his face. He's like a pearl on a deep bottom wondering inside the shell, where's the ocean? His mental questionings form the barrier. His physical eyesight bandages his knowing. Self-consciousness plugs his ears. Stay bewildered in God and only that. You know, I read that poem almost every time I'm asked to do some type of workshop around step two because it's like us hanging out in the middle of the ocean and God is the ocean and us wondering where God is. So it's like we're the fish in the ocean. And it's funny because as you go to the surface of the ocean, there's waves and there's that soapy looking stuff and there's different currents, but they're all extensions of the same ocean, right? It's the way I view this idea of God that I work with. It actually relates to something you hear in the rooms all the time. We're the last house on the block. Have you guys ever investigated what that really means? We're the last house on the block. A lot of people think because we've tried every other method and it's failed, right? I like to think about it, the last house on the block is the last place we're ever going to look to find God, which is inside. Page 55 of the Big Book tells you when you're going to find God, tells you where you're going to find God, and tells you how you're going to find God. The great reality is deep down within every man, woman, and child. Therein lies the fundamental idea of God. That's where God planted it. I think it's some like cosmic game. Let me see. I'm gonna blow creation into an infinite number of pieces, and I'm gonna give each piece amnesia. And the game is, let's see who's gonna claim their inheritance, right? I know that's a Hindu story that I heard a long time ago. I'm telling you guys, first time I heard that story, it's like one of those things that commits to your brain. Imprint. I remember it because it just made so much sense to me. And that's how I relate it to something I heard here in the rooms all the time, the last house on the block. The last analysis is what the page 55 says. Only in the last analysis. That's when. Last place we're going to look. When we're at our wit's end, when we're standing on the gates of insanity or death for people like us out of desperation, not out of any virtue, we're going to look inside to see what we find. Right? And what terrifies us is that this idea that like you're telling me I don't like what's inside, I don't want to walk into that dark forest, and you're telling me if I walk through that there's some type of God there. That's what I'm telling you. I'm asking you to at least consider it, because how is you got to lay aside prejudice, you have to think honestly, and you have to search diligently within yourself. If you can do that, you can maybe join us on the broad highway. That's how the book lays it out. God does not make too hard of terms for those who earnestly seek. The realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never forbidding or exclusive to those who seek Him. There's some of the coolest descriptions in any spiritual literature that I have ever read, and I've read a good bit, about opening you up to possibility. And that's all we're trying to do in this second step. Possibility. All right, so let's take a break. Let's come back at 10:30.